Bloomberg Law with June Grosso and Michael Best. On demand via our Bloomberg Radio Plus app. Free for iPhone and Android devices.
Welcome to Bloomberg Law for this Tuesday, June 28th. I'm June Grosso. In a 6-2 vote, the Supreme Court upheld a federal gun ban for those convicted of misdemeanor domestic violence. Why the most liberal and the most conservative justices dissented. The Supreme Court backed the broad application of a federal gun ban, ruling that domestic abusers convicted of misdemeanor assault can be barred from owning guns. Justice Elena Kagan wrote the majority opinion for six justices, rejecting the defendant's argument that the law covers only intentional or knowing acts of abuse and not those committed recklessly. In a rare occurrence, the two dissenting justices were the court's most conservative justice, Clarence Thomas, and the court's most liberal justice, Sonia Sotomayor. This case was not one of the blockbusters of the term, but it was followed closely by organizations concerned with domestic violence and gun violence. My guests are Joan Meyer, professor at George Washington University Law School, and Richard Epstein, professor at NYU Law School. Joan, let's start with the law itself, because ordinarily the federal ban on gun possession only kicks in if someone commits a felony. Tell us about this law.
That's right. This law was called the Lautenberg Amendment because in 1996, Senator Lautenberg wanted to close that loophole in the law, because while much domestic violence is felonious violence, it was typically charged or pled down to misdemeanors. And so the vast majority of domestic violence was not covered by the felony gun ban. So he specifically adopted this provision, which was an issue in the Voisin case, to cover that category, which is the vast majority of domestic violence convictions.
Richard, tell me about the defendants and their arguments.
Well, the defendants here were two people who were convicted of domestic violence under rather difficult circumstances. The verdict simply said that they were guilty, but did not specify whether it was knowing, intentional, or reckless. The federal statute, part of the general offenses under the federal law, essentially kicks in when there are offenses that involve the use of force in domestic violence, and then the question is how it is that you define this, and it turns out that when they look at this, they said, you know, when we see the use of force, what we do, the use or attempt of force, we think that it covers, as the criminal law generally covers, not only intentional actions to commit harm, but also those actions which are reckless under their circumstances. So the majority does is it looks back to the model penal code and brings into this particular case the usual equation commonly found between a reckless acts on the one hand and intentional acts on the other. What's interesting is it's highly unlikely in this particular case, when it's a specific person who's targeted by another specific person, that you actually are going to find recklessness. That's usually throwing something out of the window, not caring whom it hits. But since the underlying verdict wasn't clear, what Justice Kagan said is we read the broader interpretation into the use of force provisions and therefore sustain the conviction for holding the gun, given the nature of the predicate offense under the main statute dealing with family assaults.
Joan, tell me more about Justice Kagan's opinion. She writes this plain language sort of opinion, and she gave a couple of examples.
It's actually a great opinion, and a couple of the examples came from DV Elite, my organization's amicus brief, in fact. Before I actually get to that, I just want to add one footnote to what Richard just said about the issue of recklessness. Well, I think I agree with him that most domestic violence is not reckless, although there's probably some that might best be proven by recklessness. The problem here was that you don't know what was proven in a given case. And so all the statutes in 35 states, including D.C., that allow for reckless convictions, all of the convictions, no matter what was proven, were going to be inapplicable under this law if the petitioner's argument was adopted. So it really doesn't matter what's proven. It matters what the statutes say. And that was the problem here. In terms of Kagan's opinion, I think it's a really great example of excellent opinion writing, and contrasting that actually with the dissent is interesting, and it also is a nice contrast with the way the Castleman decision a couple years ago on the same provision is written. Anyway, she does a really nice job of just saying, look, obviously recklessness, which means under the model penal code and under most states, means a conscious disregard of a substantial risk of harm. That's plenty.
In a 6-2 vote, the Supreme Court upheld a federal gun ban for those convicted of misdemeanor domestic violence. In a rare occurrence, the court's most conservative justice, Clarence Thomas, and the court's most liberal justice, Sonia Sotomayor, dissented. This case got attention during oral arguments in February because Justice Thomas asked questions for the first time in a decade, quizzing the government attorney for examples of other instances where a misdemeanor conviction led to a loss of a constitutional right.
You're saying that recklessness is sufficient to trigger a violation, a misdemeanor violation, of domestic conduct that results in a lifetime ban on possession of a gun, which at least as of now is still a constitutional right.
Your Honor, to address—
Can you think of another constitutional right that can be suspended based upon a misdemeanor violation of a state law?
She had no other example to give Justice Thomas. He's a staunch defender of gun rights under the Second Amendment. In his dissent, he said we treat no other constitutional right so cavalierly. I've been talking with Joan Meyer, professor at George Washington University Law School, and Richard Epstein, a professor at NYU Law School. Joan, you were describing Justice Kagan's majority opinion. Please go ahead.
Yeah, well, among other things, she uses a couple examples that are adaptations of examples from our D.D. Leap amicus brief. She talks about somebody throwing a plate at a wall recklessly, causing injury to the wife who's nearby but not aiming it at the wife. And she talks about someone slamming a door as they're leaving, knowing that the wife is following and happening to catch her fingers in the slammed door. So these are great examples of reckless conduct that might, you know, you might be unable to prove that he intended the harm, but he recklessly committed acts that caused the harm, and it's absurd to suggest that that somehow is not a use of force that entitles one to apply the federal gun ban. So she does a nice job on that, and she just does a really nice job of sort of very cleanly and clearly laying out both the federal law, the way these intent standards really work in real life and under the law, and reconciling this with past decisions of the court. The other thing she does really nicely that we think is quite important on behalf of the domestic violence field is that she takes on the notion that not only the petitioners argued, but also the government kind of bought into, which is the idea that the ancient common law dating back to pre-constitutional days in England, that whatever was being done in the olden days in judicial courts in England and here should define how we understand terms like use of force or how we understand misdemeanor convictions. And Kagan very clearly says there's absolutely no reason to suspect that Congress intended to go back to a common law definition. Modern criminal law uses the Model Penal Code and has really modernized the norms in terms of what kinds of intent can be proven and suffice for criminal liability, and we're not going to be beholden to the criminal law here. And that was very interesting because while we argued it in our amicus brief, the government, which is very persuasive and powerful voice in these cases, actually said the common law should control, but argued that the common law supported the same position that Kagan came out in. And Kagan said, look, between the government and the petitioner, everybody's arguing about what the common law shows. Frankly, we think it's very mixed up and we can't get any guidance from it, nor do we think we should be bound by it. That's really important for women's issues in particular, because women's issues were simply not recognized under the early common law. And so often when Justice Scalia recently and other members of the court would look to the ancient law to decide what the Constitution means or statute means, there would be no guidance, and the negative implication would be that women's rights are not protected.
All right. Let's give Richard a chance to get in and see if he agrees with what you've been saying.
I did not write a brief in this case, but there's some serious errors in the argument. Let me first start with the statute. The statute says it's not what Justice Kagan quoted. It says, has as an element the use of or attempted use of physical force. Now, it turns out under the criminal law, if you're talking about attempts, you have to have a specific intention to commit the crime. Recklessness will not support an intent violation. So as a matter of statutory construction, when you put those words back in, whatever the general criminal law, it sort of suggests in this particular case that if the specific intent requirement is required with respect to attempts, it has to be acquired with respect to use. What Justice Kagan said, telling that the recklessness generally often totes up to intention is in fact true, but you're talking about a specific statute. You're not talking about a general proposition. And I think on that issue, Justice Thomas has the stronger side.
I stop you for one moment. Tell me about Justice Thomas's dissent.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. What he does, in effect, is to stress the fact that, sure, you could show that there's verbal cases of recklessness, but if you're actually trying to figure out what the statute means, particularly if you add the word intent in, it reads like a specific intention statute across the way. It doesn't read like a recklessness statute. So the fact that in many other contexts we equate the two things doesn't resolve the question of statutory interpretation. The second point, which is very ironic about this case, is in the Castleman case to which Joan referred, there everybody says, well, when we don't have any clear definition of what's going on, what we do is we manage to revert back to the common law. And now 2 years later, all of a sudden, the common law turns out to be irrelevant. And there's this kind of jarring inconsequity. The irony is, of course, I think there's actually a stronger case as a matter of first principle for having the punishment here, because recklessness is a lot more serious with respect to the way in which you behave than offensive touching, like, you know, spilling something on somebody else's lap, which could...
Joan,
June, I've got to correct the statutory statement. It covers use of force. It also covers attempted, threatened, whatever, but it covers use of force. Therefore, it's in no way a specific intent statute. That's just a misconception about the statute. In terms of the dissent, it's very interesting that it's combining Sotomayor and Thomas. And the way I read it is that the first two parts that Sotomayor agrees with that have to do with the construction of the statute are really kind of mirrors of how she wrote the Castleman decision, which we just both mentioned. In both decisions, she's parsing the words very closely and doing a kind of a convoluted and rather complex and somewhat hard to follow analysis of different iterations of different conduct and whether they constitute reckless, intentional, this, that, or the other. Why I like Kagan's decision is that she really goes to the heart of the matter in terms of both what the statute means and how conduct works and how prosecution works. It's not a policy opinion, but it's a sensible reading of the statute that's consistent with the obvious intent. Sotomayor and Thomas are really parsing words in a way that gets you far, far away from reality, talking about, for instance, a car crash that's reckless that happens to hurt the child within the car, and would that then subject you to the firearms gun ban? And nobody thinks it would, because it really wouldn't be likely to be prosecuted as an assault, as a reckless assault on a child. That's just not what it is, and it wouldn't be charged that way. So they're really spinning out to unreal scenarios in order to make their argument. One other thing that's striking, though, I think.
You know what, Joan, I just want to hold for a second and let Richard get a comment in here.
Well, thank you. I mean, it's very difficult. Look, in terms of reading the statute, it's quite clear that there are lots of cases in which you want to treat recklessness like intention. But if you have a specific statute, generally what you try to read is the whole thing. The exact language of the statute, which he did not quote in full, was, has as an element the use or attempted use of physical force. And when you're dealing with the attempted use of physical force, either you show there's a specific intent or you cannot support the offense. So what I think the best argument for Justice Thomas, which he did not make, I think, is you read the two parallels together and you have here a pretty strong evidence they don't want recklessness. I think politically it's a disaster because, as Joan said, it's clearly the case when you start looking at these kinds of things that most of the time the recklessness is going to be very, very serious and you'd like to punish it. And you could either clean up the federal statute, or what you could do at the state level, knowing that this statute is around, is actually get special verdicts in which you instruct people to say, find out whether it was intentional or merely reckless, and that will solve the problem.
I am sorry to say that we have come to the end of the show, and it has been a very involved discussion. I appreciate both of you being here. That's Richard Epstein, professor at NYU Law School, and Joan Meyer, professor at George Washington University Law School. Thanks so much for being on Bloomberg Law. And now let's take a look at the top story on BloombergLaw.com. Volkswagen has agreed to spend more than $15 billion to get hundreds of thousands of emissions-cheating diesel vehicles off U.S. roads after a scandal that continues to rattle the international auto market. That's it for this edition of Bloomberg Law. We'll be back tomorrow. With All Due Respect is next for our Washington, D.C. audience, and Bloomberg Best is next for our listeners in New York, Boston, and San Francisco. Thanks to our technical director, Reginald Bazile, and our producer, David Sutcherman. I'm June Grosso. Have a great evening. See you again tomorrow.
You can listen to Bloomberg Law weekday afternoons at 4:30 p.m. Eastern, in New York on Bloomberg 1130, in Boston on 1200 a.m. and 94.5 FM HD2, in San Francisco on 960 a.m. and 103.7 FM HD2, and Sirius XM Satellite Radio Channel 119.